In the intricate world of Korean affairs, tailored intelligence makes all the difference. Korea Risk Group's consulting services offer specialized, actionable intelligence designed to guide your career-related decisions. We provide bespoke consulting services that cater to your unique challenges and goals. From policy analysis to market entry strategies, we bring clarity to complexity. Transform uncertainty into opportunity and visit careerpro.com solutions today. Listeners, and welcome to the NK News Podcast. I'm your host, Jacko Zwetsluit, and today it is Tuesday, the 16th of April, 2024. I'm joined here in the studio by Chad O'Carroll. Chad, welcome back.
Hi, it's been a while.
It has been a while. Now, yesterday, of course, was the day of the sun, and I thought we would talk about things that happened yesterday, but there's something more exciting that you've proposed to me, and that's your meaty article that you've written for NK Pro. Released on the Day of the Sun, so it came out yesterday, so it is technically a Day of the Sun event, about what to do now that the United Nations panel of experts on North Korean sanctions is winding up at the end of this month. And that is certainly a big deal in the North Korea Watchers community. So just give us a quick summary for our listeners. What's the panel of experts and why is it winding down?
Yeah, so the panel of experts is a United Nations group of consultants who specialize in monitoring North Korea, in this case, North Korea sanctions evasion, trends in sanctions implementation, and so on. And since I think it was 2009 or 2010, the panel of experts has most years written at least one report, sometimes two, more recently two.
And they report to the Security Council,
right? To the Security Council, right. And they've been reporting on the state of play. These reports have always been very insightful for people interested in how North Korea is able to skirt sanctions and grow economically, and also always shed some light on some of the foreign partners and interlocutors that North Korea is engaging with to get around sanctions. You always typically learn quite a lot from these reports. But in the last 3-4 years, maybe 5 years, the panel's work has become increasingly politicized. And within the panel, there are different countries who always have a so-called independent expert, right, in the mix.
They're often former diplomats or diplomats on sabbatical from their foreign ministry, right? So they're not unconnected to the diplomatic sphere back home.
Yeah. And, you know, it's always said that the Chinese and Russian experts are very close to the UN missions of those countries. But it's also true to say that some of the other folks within the panel of experts are also close to their missions. For example, the last two South Korean independent experts have come straight from the foreign ministry, have regular meetings with their respective missions. Mm-hmm. Japan also has sent people to join the panel who have worked in embassies here in Seoul in the past. The UK, which has always provided the coordinator, I think 9 times out of 10, that's always a former FCO diplomat. Just one case, it wasn't Hugh Griffiths. So you can see it's a general trend. But anyway, because of that, and because of the sort of disagreements from a bird's eye view between key P5 countries about the value of sanctions on North Korea, that's dripped down into the panel's activities increasingly in recent years. And Russia this year just said enough's enough. We don't want to support the panel anymore. It's now become a tool of the West. They didn't talk about the fact that the panel is probably going to increasingly be focusing on DPRK, Russia military cooperation, or claims thereof.
Yep.
And so actually until April 30th, there is still time for nations to fix this problem and come to some consensus and rebuild the panel, mm-hmm, or sort of realign consensus for it. But
right,
the chances of that happening are quite low, I'd say, at this point.
In the next 2 weeks, right. So Russia vetoed the extension and China abstained from the vote. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
Now, of course, the problem with these sanctions that I've heard many times is that sanctions and investigations of sanctions evasion come down to the individual member states, right? There is no global police force policing the sanctions. It's up to each individual member state to enforce the sanctions and to report lack of enforcement.
Yeah, there are certain types of North Korea sanctions where the United Nations did agree at the Security Council to explicitly define certain products that would constitute clear-cut sanctions violations. So, for example, luxury goods, there were, you know, like things like speedboats or motor cars were agreed unanimously as things that shouldn't be going into North Korea. But at the end of the day, you're right. It's down to, for example, the Chinese customs officials working in Dandong to screen those products out of the entry into North Korea.
Okay, so we're at this situation where it looks like 2 weeks from now, at the end of April, this panel will not exist anymore. And so then comes the question, what are the alternatives? I mean, the sanctions are not going to go away. The only thing that's going away is the panel of experts that monitors the sanctions enforcement and evasion. So that you've got in your article here, which I recommend everyone go and read at Korea Pro, it's called After the Panel. What are some alternative mechanisms that that might appear to keep sanctions monitoring alive?
Yeah, so first I'd just say that we should consider the fact that this panel problem has occurred on Iran. Some years ago when the JCPOA was signed, the Iran panel lost its mandate. And also most recently with Mali, there was a panel of experts working on that. So we need to consider the fact that probably as the sort of Cold War 2.0 impasse grows at the UN Security Council, we may see more and more panels losing their mandate.
Yeah.
That brings to question maybe a need for a broader view on how to solve this from a more holistic perspective. But that being said, if we just consider the North Korea portfolio, the first idea...
we've got five, right?
Four ideas.
Beg your pardon, I've miscounted. We've got four alternatives you've put forward.
And I think, to be honest, the first two are the most serious contenders. The other two are in some ways happening already.
Mm-hmm.
But the first is to establish a global sanctions monitoring mechanism through the UN General Assembly. Now,
that means a wider involvement of all the member states in the General Assembly, not just P5 and a few others.
Well, so normally the General Assembly wouldn't have the authority to create something like the Panel of Experts. But in 2016, something interesting happened. China and Russia vetoed a ceasefire resolution at the UNSC on Syria. And the way the General Assembly responded was to create what was called the International Impartial and Independent Mechanism, IIIM.
Yeah. Doesn't really roll off the tongue, does it? How do you say that? IIIM?
Yeah. So they built that in December 2016 to investigate and prosecute serious human rights abuses, crimes in Syria.
Right.
And it's a really interesting concept because it initially was based on voluntary funding from members of the United Nations General Assembly who had agreed about the importance of this. But eventually it's got itself locked in as a actually core UN-funded initiative. So it has some staying power. And the goal of that is to collect, consolidate, preserve, and analyze evidence of crimes against humanity, et cetera, in Syria, and provide prosecutors and courts around the world with primary source information if there's ever a push to go after legally some of the people that were sort of at the end of these investigations.
Right.
So theoretically, that could offer a blueprint for something similar, but this, rather than focusing on crimes against humanity and such, to focus on North Korea sanctions compliance. So that's the general idea.
Now, you've gone, for all of these four, you've got some advantages and some disadvantages, some pros and cons. Without giving all of the game away, what's your take on this first option, the Syria model? What are some of the pluses and minuses in
the ledger? I think the biggest one is that it wouldn't be the same UN level of authority, but it would still have a UN sort of stamp on it, which I think would be just good in general for its credibility, and when it reaches out to certain individuals and companies, it would, you know, have a kind of air of authority. It would theoretically also be open to China and Russia should they change their mind about the role of sanctions in future.
Right, because everyone can be involved.
Yeah. Inclusive and lots of opportunities for collaboration with NGOs, think tanks, research groups, etc.
What about some downsides?
Downsides, I think, obviously, you'd have lack of cooperation from two biggest players, probably China and Russia, which is the lion's share of where sanctions issues of concern are taking place.
Yep.
We saw with this Syria model, there were sometimes shortfalls in financing.
So money could be a problem.
Yep.
And then if money is a problem, finding the good staff to work at an organization could be a problem, because who wants to be, you know, told, well, we can't pay you this month, or you're on furlough this month, maybe come back in a few months or something. Yeah,
exactly. And if it only gets funding for a year or two, who's going to, like, you know, quit their job, go to New York City, and then, you know, you would.
I would like to live in New York City. If anyone has a job for me out there at this new panel that that Chad's proposed, I'll come and do it.
And then I think, you know, you might, I think this is something that afflicts all of the ideas when I start thinking through them, is whenever you have a group of like-minded countries on something like this, backing an initiative like this, you just have to fast forward and think about, well, what if we have a situation like 2018 again, where you have a president like Moon Jae-in in South Korea who has Kim Jong-un's ear and Kim Jong-un is showing interest again. There would a few months, maybe a year down the line, if that process shows signs of warming, that could translate into friction within this supposedly independent body if South Korea is a big backer into it.
Right.
Or if the US is a big backer, like Trump might do the same.
Right.
And then you can you could have, like, not just funding shortfalls, but also friction about what kind of information to divulge from this research, and whether it could undermine the, you know, spring diplomacy that might be emerging, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, what about the second alternative then? And I've got the list here, so I'll read it out. Establish a multilateral sanctions monitoring institute, so separate of the United Nations.
Yeah. So this would be so-called like-minded nations basically clubbing together, throwing some serious finance into the mix, and building some kind of institute that would be tasked with global sanctions investigation.
But just on North Korea?
I would actually say it's probably more compelling if it was on all sanctions regimes.
Right. So they could have departments, one on Iran, one on North Korea, one on Syria, that sort of thing.
Because you'd then benefit from actually being able to build up skilled staff with competencies in, like, open source intelligence analysis.
Right.
Or let's say trade data statistics, or, you know, things of that ilk, and then cyber. And then rather than, you know, having all these in the North Korea panel, we've just had so many diplomats, some of whom are really good at learning this stuff on the fly, but some of them have not been very impressive. I won't name names, obviously, but
you know who you are.
You know who you are.
Who would this institute report to?
I guess it would report to the countries that back it, and also that it would really need to have a major public facing element. And I think where it would have real benefits compared to the UN, which is quite slow, bureaucratic, technologically backwards, is, you know, policymakers want sanctions to have impact, and the corporate sector is kind of like the coalface of where that plays out usually. But the problem with the existing PDF-based output that these panels produce is, A, it's only once or twice a year. It's not timely. It's not real time. And B, it's very hard for major banks to digest this, because it's just if it was in an API accessible data point where...
Wait, for those of us at home, what's an API?
Application, I don't know, actually. Oh. I think it's...
what does it mean?
It's basically an access point to a database that allows structured export of data that can be digested by the consumer organization and sucked into their network, basically into their database.
Okay, so not a giant PDF with 400 pages, but in a way that you can port this information into your own data. Okay,
right. Yeah. So
it, more usable.
Much more usable. So and if it could be pushing out in real time, that would enable banks to maintain much more up-to-date listings of the types of organizations and people to avoid. So it would have, could have a lot more real life impact, which is what policymakers, I assume, want.
Right. Would this this institute liaise with the United Nations Security Council, since that's the organization that set the sanctions?
Yeah, I think it could make recommendations to, as many have said so far, like the sanctions aren't going away. The Russia hasn't been able to veto the sanctions.
Uh-huh.
So the sanctions still exist. So this group could make recommendations that P5 members could bring to the table and say, look, there's this really outrageous evidence here of X and Y violations of sanction. We need to do something about this. It could bring it to the 17-18 committee responsible for North Korea sanctions. And yeah, so that would probably not actually translate into designations, because China and Russia might be opposed. But we're at a point now where I think the corporate sector, especially global banks, they know that there's this deep freeze at the UNSC. And I think if there's something authoritative putting out recommendations, it's probably just going to err on the side of caution and just blacklist whoever is recommended for designation, rather than only those who are formally designated.
Now, one disadvantage I can think of this proposal is it would need a lot of money to set up an independent institute. You'd need to, you know, get the real estate in a world city, and then good people to run it, and technology and things. And who's going to pay for all that?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've seen in the Syria case that there were people that were ready to step up and provide voluntary finance. So I assume there are stakeholders here who would be compelled. And, you know, it doesn't need to be that much. I mean, we'd say a budget of even like $5 to $10 million a year, you could do some pretty robust, you could do some very robust work on that kind of money.
And that could be done remotely. You wouldn't have to be.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be in New York City.
In Manhattan, yeah. Now, idea three, I like this one. Build a network of think tanks, media, and researchers. That's something that NK News could get involved in. And you might end up sending me to New York on behalf of NK News to work on this new thing. Do you think that's a viable alternative?
Yeah, so basically this is, and I think this is happening already to some extent. You do see certain news publications, think tanks that are provided seeds of information about sanctions violations, which they can then piggyback on and put out their own reports. The key thing is that, you know, while lots of people in the open source community can dedicate time to researching North Korea sanctions violations, oftentimes they might be blind to some of the initial indicators that give them a sense of where to start digging.
Right.
So basically, countries that have that intel would need to structurally come to some kind of agreement amongst themselves that this is in our interest to share confidential intel with this like pre sort of checked group of third party individuals, NGOs, etc.
Right. So there'd be some issues there about classified information. And then the last idea, which scrolling to that now, is conducting regular multilateral sanctions review meetings. That's just what, meetings within the UN?
No, I mean, it would be like, and this is again probably already happening, like G7 nations getting together every quarter to discuss and share the latest intel. I think a key thing would be inviting and including third party experts, open source specialists, cyber crypto experts, etc. And basically create that I think among the countries that have an ability to actually pass this information to their criminal justice system to try and actually stop bad actors in their tracks. It could also have a role of like actually putting out some kind of statements or public data or reports for others to act upon. But I mean, I think this is happening already to some extent, but I think if you're a country that really wants to provide teeth to sanctions regimes, including North Korea, it's probably not enough, to be honest.
Right. Okay. For listeners, go and look at the article at NK Pro, because you'll see all the pros and cons and the plus and minus of each of the four things. But under pinning all of this, or underlying all of this, Chad, is the question of what are sanctions there for? What are they? What are we trying? What's the United Nations trying to achieve with sanctions against North Korea? Are the, you know, it's a theme that we've returned to over the years on this podcast. Are they there to be punitive? Are they there to change North Korea's mind about how it acts? Give us a bit of a spiel on that.
Yeah, this is, I think, the most important question. I've done this from the perspective of a policymaker or country that really cares about giving teeth to the sanctions regime. But I think Russia and China, maybe this will be an unpopular opinion amongst many of our listeners, I think they raised valid points about the general purpose of the sanctions regime. Like, what is the point of sanctioning a country like North Korea to this extent and thus far providing zero evidence of any UN Security Council interest in dialing down those sanctions when, quote unquote, North Korea is behaving as it did in some areas mm-hmm. in 2018 and 2019. Thus far, we've just seen sanctions go one way. And I think there is a real risk with all of these ideas, and even if these ideas aren't on the table, just in general amongst some foreign ministries that want to look like they are taking action, of sanctions being an end of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So you risk kind of creating a forever sanctions culture through any and all of these ideas, which might overlook what the probably would overlook what the purpose of sanctions is. And it's not to just create huge listings and databases of people and actors to avoid for financial actors like banks and the corporate sector.
Yep.
These lists are already huge. They're getting bigger and bigger by the day. Mm. And what are they achieving on North Korea explicitly? You know, some argue that it's slowing their nuclear program down.
Mm-hmm.
I think the key risk is with all of this is you're just going to divide the world even more into a world, a side of the world that really cares about listing and prohibiting people from activity and taking part in that financial system and being able to buy products and services. And as that listing builds, you create a sort of other world of those who are prohibited
mm.
and start creating their own frameworks for exchange and cooperation that the sanctions regime has no oversight mm. or teeth into. And with the geopolitical divisions we're having now at the UN over Russia, China, etc., mm. I think long term, if this continues, like you just have to think 30, 40 years down the line, you'll have like an alignment of countries who are all targets here,
right?
And find that this is, you know, an overreach into their national sovereignty, who've just basically built their own marketplace of commodities, oil, coal, that are all under sanction, but right. which can be traded freely amongst themselves.
Like a kind of dark web.
Exactly, exactly. And then this all becomes a bit academic.
Right. Last question for you, Chad. I know it's a bit early because this article only came out yesterday, but have you heard any responses from stakeholders in this process, in or around the panel of experts or the 17-18 Sanctions Commission? Or do you expect to be, you know, this to become sort of the grounds for a larger conversation about what to do in the future that you may be drawn into now that you've written this wonderful analysis?
Well, it's too early. Yeah. I only published it last night.
Yeah.
But already some nations are expressing publicly, like the US, that they are continuing to fight for the panel of experts' existence and that others are talking about consideration of other options. So I think this is just this discussion is already taking place. Maybe these ideas have already been thought up.
Mm.
I think the General Assembly one, I wouldn't have, to be totally honest, I wouldn't have thought about that if a diplomat at the UN hadn't said to me, Chad, that this is one idea that is actually under consideration. So I did a bit of research into that. But yeah, we'll see where it goes. I mean, it's the end of the panel of experts is going to be lamentable for many, but it's going to provide opportunities, I think, for the corporate sector to sort of build something in its place we already do a lot of the functions of the panel of experts,
right?
Just by researching on North Korea issues
and publishing in near real time.
Yeah,
faster than the twice yearly reports.
Exactly,
yeah.
And providing structured databases, etc. So we're already doing a lot of those things. But again, I say all that also cognizant of the fact that I think we are, you know, there's an industry that is forming very clearly around sanctions listings, sanctions recommendations, sanctions investigation. And just zooming out, I don't know if it's necessarily good, because it's clearly on North Korea, it's clearly not having very many positive impacts.
The desired effects, right. Okay, well, that's what we'll have to stop for today. But if you have an NK Pro subscription, go online, read the article after the panel, Weighing the Best Alternatives to Monitor North Korean Sanctions by Chad O'Carroll, released just yesterday, April 15th, the day of the sun, very auspicious day. And if you don't yet have an NK Pro subscription, well, jolly well go out there and get one. Stay tuned, because after this break, I have an interview with Lieutenant Colonel Aaron Trimble, retired of the United States Air Force, talking about his experiences of setting up a series of meetings back in the 1990s with the North Korean People's Army to de-escalate situations. It's a very interesting interview, so come back for that. All right, thanks, Chad. See you soon.
All right, thank you.
Get to the core of Korean insights with KoreaPro's exclusive Seoul event series. Join us for gatherings that bring you face-to-face with key opinion leaders, journalists, and experts on South Korean affairs for dinner, drinks, and more. Engage in deep discussions on political, economic, and social issues at special venues across Seoul. From dinners with KoreaPro editors to insightful conversations with renowned guests, each event promises a unique blend of expertise and networking. Immerse yourself in the pulse of Korea. Register now at events.koreapro.org. Hello, listeners, and welcome to the podcast. This interview is recorded on Tuesday, April 9th, 2024. Seoul time via StreamYard. It's a new package we're trying out. And I'm joined online by retired US Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Alan Trimble to talk about his experiences organizing general level meetings with North Koreans almost 30 years ago and why that is still relevant and worth talking about today. Welcome on the show, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so we're going to talk about your experiences at Panmunjom negotiating with North Koreans to institutionalize and regularize general officers meetings. But before we do, let's go back to 1992, when you were first assigned to work in Korea. And you were, I believe, at U.S. Forces Korea J2 for about 2 years. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
Can you tell us what is J2 and what it does?
It's essentially the intelligence function for U.S. Forces Korea, working with the South Koreans to monitor and watch for activities up in North Korea.
Okay. And what was your role there?
I was the Air Force chief, responsible for the air activities and things like that.
Okay. So your organization at that time was collecting and analyzing the intelligence, and then some other department goes off and makes the strategies and policies from that. Is that correct?
That's pretty close, yes.
Okay. And how long were you in that role?
2 years.
2 years. Okay. So from 92 to 94.
That's correct.
Now, during that time, a lot went on, namely a period that we now call the first North Korean nuclear crisis. And then for the sake of our listeners who may not be familiar with all the details, I'm going to briefly recount some of the main events during that time, just to set the context. Please let me know if I missed anything or if I get anything wrong. So I'll start before you came to Korea, which is in July 1991, when for the first time, a South Korean general was made the senior delegate to the United Nations Military Armistice Commission, or UNCMAC. North Korea did not react well to this, and I believe that its delegation did not attend UNCMAC meetings for a while in protest. And then we fast forward to March 1993. By this stage, you're working here at USFK J2, when North Korea announced its withdrawal from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT. The next month, in April 1993, North Korea expelled the Czech component
of the Neutral Nations Supervisory Commission, and 2 years later, the Polish component. Since then, North Korea has not recognized the existence of the NNSC. In March 1994, the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, was given 2 weeks to look around North Korea's nuclear facilities, but not the main radiochemical facility, which was used for fuel reprocessing. Also in March 94, North Korea threatened to withdraw from the Korean Armistice Agreement and stopped participating in the Military Armistice Commission. In response, the Chinese People's Volunteers stopped attending meetings at Panmunjom in May 1994. And in June 1994, it looked like US President Clinton might launch a preemptive strike to take out the Yongbyon nuclear reactor. Shortly after that, former President Jimmy Carter visited Pyongyang and met Kim Il-sung to work out the beginnings of a deal that would be signed in October 1994 called the Agreed Framework. That's more or less my brief summary of it. Did I miss anything important during that period?
Not that I'm aware of. A lot of that, of course, is way above my pay grade. I was just down in the weeds trying to do my job. And one thing I would point out, if anybody is interested in more about the Korean Armistice, Ashton Orm's interview was excellent, especially the Armistice Agreement, the UNC, Military Armistice Commission, and the formal meetings under the MAC. And that was a great start for anybody who might be interested.
I will thank you for mentioning that. I will mention the number of the interview so people can go back and find it. Just going to search that now. Yep. So that is episode number 205. So I encourage people to go back and listen to episode 205 with Ashton Orms talking about his experiences at the UN command around that time. Now, when in 1994 did you leave your position at J2 and finish your time in Korea? Your first stint in Korea?
Well, I left Korea in 94, turned back to Washington, D.C., was there 3 years, and then that brought me up to 97. I had the opportunity to apply for and get the position at the United Nations Command Military Armistice Commission as the International Political and Military Affairs Officer, or the IPMAO, as everybody called them.
That's a mouthful. Give that again. The International Political Military Affairs Officer, IPMAO. Okay.
Which is why they go to the IPMAO. It's just too much to run through every time.
Right. Now, were you still here in June 94 when Jimmy Carter made his visit?
I think I was. Like I say, I was pretty much, you know, down in the weeds trying to take care of my job. And I'm sure there were a lot of generals running around more concerned about what was going on with that than I was. I was just a major at the time.
I see. Okay. So then, we fast forward 3 years to 97, and you're assigned to the United Nations Command Military Armistice Commission, or UNCMAC. And this gave you direct on-the-ground experience in Panmunjom. And so now we're going into the period after the signing of the agreed framework, when North Korea had frozen its nuclear weapons development program and the U.S. was delivering oil and food aid. Is that when you worked with multiple pod-time guest Steve Tharp?
Steve came later on in my tour. Can't remember. He's much better at remembering dates, so he could probably tell you exactly when he arrived and that. But I want to say it was somewhere around in the middle of my second tour, our okay. second year there. So probably about in 98. You know, going into 99.
All right. Now, what is the role of the International Political Military Affairs Officer, or IPMAO? What do you have to do?
Well, essentially, my responsibility and all IPMAO responsibilities were to develop strategies, recommended policy positions for the armistice negotiations with the KPA. For every meeting, we would plot out talking points, possible issues that might come up. And, you know, I have everybody pretty much prepared to go in and respond to anything that the North Koreans may bring up and to put forth any issues or concerns or topics that we needed to. So it was essentially every meeting had fingerprints from the IPMAO on it. And that was all the way up to the GO meetings, which, of course, as Ash Norton said, were much more formalized. Every word that the general said in those meetings were written by me on the UNC side.
Okay, so when you arrived there, when you started that job in 1997, were regular meetings at the general level being held?
No, there were not. And in fact, they had started after the North Koreans came in, let me check my date here just to be sure. In 95, the North Koreans came back and proposed what they called general officer talks. They recognized a need to get what they wanted, and they couldn't do that at the secretary or the staff level meetings. So they also wanted the general officer meetings.
Okay.
When they proposed this, the South Korean government was adamantly opposed to this idea, this concept. They believed that the MAC was the proper structure for dealing with armistice issues. But we continued to meet with the North Koreans to talk about developing the wording for a procedural document. In other words, in 95, my predecessor, or excuse me, in 95, my predecessor started meeting with the North Koreans to develop the wording for how these meetings would go, all with the understanding that they probably would never happen as long as the South Korean government was opposed to it.
Now, that may be a bit hard for our listeners to get their heads around, because there are different meetings. There's the MAC meetings, and there's general officer meetings and staff meetings. And you said that the South Korean government at that time was opposed to the idea of general officers meetings. Say a bit more about that, just to let it sink in.
Well, I have to fast forward a little bit. You had Kim Dae-jung become president in 1998.
Yeah, began in 98. Yeah,
for 97. From that moment on, the South Korean government turned around 180 degrees, and we immediately received word to go ahead and start. So it was a matter of the different policies and the different politics of the South Korean government at the time. Now, I'm not a South Korean, you know, historian, and I don't know as much about what was going on then. But we do know that the government, up until Kim Dae-jung was elected, was opposed to it.
A feeling that they were being shut out of these meetings? Is that maybe something to do with it?
Absolutely. The North Koreans made it clear from the very beginning that this should be a bilateral event.
So when you say bilateral, you mean U.S. and North Korea only, not US with the North South Korean alliance partner. I see.
And their position continually was that there was no longer a United Nations command. Therefore, it was only the United States that mattered.
I see.
And this was the general theme through all of the development of the wording for this procedural document, was that they were doing what they've always been doing, which is to try to get it away from the United Nations command and then to a bilateral U.S.-North Korean relationship.
Right. And that seems to, I connect that in my mind to what I mentioned earlier back in, I think it was 1991, I have to scroll up in my notes here, 91, when for the first time a South Korean general was made the senior delegate to the Military Armistice Commission. North Korea didn't like that, didn't attend those meetings. And so it seems, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems that North Korea wanted to pivot away from these Military Armistice Commission meetings to these bilateral ones that you're talking about, to avoid having to talk to South Korean generals.
And one of the things I want to raise is that the North Koreans were pretty predictable in what they wanted all along. They were very good at manipulating and trying to get what they wanted in other ways, but they always were very clear, even if they pretended they weren't, that this was what they wanted. So it was actually pretty easy for us to look at everything that they were trying to do and put it in context as to, well, how does this give them what they ultimately want? And it allowed us to be able to a little bit of a buffer to keep them from getting what they wanted. And so we were constantly trying to work around that issue. And, you know, once, like I said, once the DJ government came into being, then it was a matter of move forward, get the wording done on the procedural document, and let's get these meetings going.
So Kim Dae-jung was inaugurated as president in late February of 1998, and these general officers meetings, these crisis management dialogue channel, began a couple of months later on the 23rd of June 1998, just a couple of days ahead of the anniversary of the start of the Korean War. So tell us about that process, how that process worked of setting up these meetings. You said there was a lot of wording that had to be agreed on in procedural documents.
That's correct. Yeah, it started out, it was mostly at the staff officer level meetings where we wordsmithed a lot of the document. And when I say staff officer level meetings, I don't know if Ash Orm raised that. There are a number of meetings that were going on, even though the MAC meetings were no longer going on. You had the secretary meetings, which Ashton talked about a little bit. Then you had the staff officer meetings.
Now, what ranks would they be, just for our listeners who may not be familiar?
I would always be the lead officer, a lieutenant colonel, and my counterpart would be a KPA colonel. And so the difference between the secretary meetings and the staff officer meetings, the secretary meetings were had all the representatives there. They had the one other nation representative attending. They had the ROC advisory group attending. It was anywhere from about 15 or so people crammed in a small room.
Wow.
So
15 or so people per side or in total over the...
In total. The KPA usually had four or five people. And then we had, we'd have the secretary. Sometimes the assistant or deputy secretary would attend. You had the staff officers. That would be myself, the language officer, and maybe one or two other officers. And then you'd have the representative from the other nations who, you know, I can tell you the countries that were there at the time.
Is that a rotating role? So
yes,
any one of those. Okay, so any one of the other. Correct me if I'm wrong. 16 sending nations would rotate.
Except
through.
We didn't have 16 representatives at the time. I think we only had about 9, including the U.S.
Right.
Let me just try off the top of my head. You had British representative. You had an Australian representative, you had a New Zealand representative, you had a French, Thai, Filipino, I'm sure I'm forgetting somebody, and maybe one more. And then they would rotate. Okay. They were all defense attaché.
Right. So there was always then a defense attaché of one of the other sending states in the United Nations command sitting in the meeting there watching.
Except he was wearing his United Nations command military armistice commission hat. He was not the defense attaché in that room.
Right. Got it. Okay. Yep. And so you had these are the meetings held at the staff officer level to wordsmith.
Secretary
level. Beg your pardon. Secretary level.
These were the secretary level. They were much more representative. They were a little bit more formal, although technically they were informal meetings. But they were generally things that required a more senior level decision making to take place.
Right.
Now, the staff officer meetings were very different. They were generally U.S. officers from United Nations Command facing KPA. No Koreans, no foreign nationals, just Americans and South and North Koreans.
Okay, so it's a very stripped down meeting.
Right.
Was it less formal, less structured?
It depended. It was essentially more of a working level, which is why a lot of the wordsmithing that took place with the procedural document took place at those meetings.
Okay.
And it was literally an opportunity for it. Both sides to kind of wangle around with the wording before they needed to go to the secretary level and start really hammering things and saying, this is critical to us as opposed to what you're wanting to say here. Yeah. So it was more give and take in the staff officer level meetings than it was in the secretary. And then you had the third meeting, which it was the JDO meetings, which were primarily administrative of the JSA. So
the joint duty officers. So if one of the buildings on conference room needed to be repainted or repaired or something like that, that would be discussed at the JDO level. Is that right?
Right. And arranging the repatriation ceremonies and anything that had to do administratively with or logistically within the JSA.
Right.
So essentially, you had the secretary meetings and then you had the staff officer level meetings as it pertained to the general officer talks.
Okay, so once you had come to an agreement with North Korea and also with South Korea, as you point out, and these meetings began in June 1998, what function did they serve? What did they actually achieve?
In my opinion, it achieved very little. This is just my opinion. It was nothing more than a MAC meeting. The United Nations command side treated it as such. The KPA side saw it as an avenue to try to get changes made to the arrangements. So, for example, they would come in and say, we want to propose a trilateral group, because later on they went from U.S. KPA to U.S. KPA and the South Koreans, because after all, the South Koreans had a whole bunch of soldiers down south.
Right.
So even from the beginning, the meetings were on the North Korean side intended to make changes to what they saw as things they did not care for. And that was the UNCMAC and the armistice to some degree, but they couldn't break away from the armistice at that point in time. So the plan going in, and we're kind of jumping around a little bit, the plan going in was that we wanted these meetings to always have a purpose. And so the first meeting, for example, the purpose we went in there was to announce that a North Korean Yugo sub had been captured in the south and that its crew members had all died, and that we gave them a protest, an official protest under the armistice, and then we offered to return and repatriate the remains. The North Koreans were not prepared for this. So they tried to just kind of ignore it. And then they immediately went into what they wanted the GEO meetings to be. And if I can find my notes from the first one here, I can. Yeah, their statements were essentially they wanted to establish a peace treaty. They wanted a U.S. withdrawal of forces from the peninsula and then develop a new peace mechanism. So there again, the peace mechanism, something to replace the armistice or UNCMAC or whatever they ultimately wanted to do, which was to, we used to call it baby steps. They were always looking to get you to step back a little baby step, and then they can step forward and keep you going backwards. But that first meeting was a failure for them because, one, they were unprepared to hear about the Yugo submarine, and they were not prepared to respond to it, because obviously they don't react free flow. They have to go back and get permission to say whatever they say. Mm-hmm. So now we're into the second meeting, and then they came back, and then they gave us their version of what happened with the Yugo sub, that it got off track in a training exercise in the north, it drifted south, and that we killed them and captured the sub. And so that was the reason for the second meeting. And so it became a matter of back and forth. Now, talking about the format itself, I would carry the book in that we would use for the MAC meeting, which was about this thick. And in it was every response that we would make to any comments made by the North Koreans. And so aside from any pre-written statements or comments made by the UNC side, if the North Koreans accused us of this, that, or the other, I would flip over to that particular section in the big book, and I would pull out the appropriate response and hand it to the general and say, this is what you respond with. So very formal. Mm. It was only useful in that it did give us an opportunity to show at a general officer level concerns that we had. Again, Yugo submarine, South Korea, shouldn't have been there, but magnanimously we'll return the remains if you want them, which we ultimately did return the remains.
Right. Were these meetings held regularly or only at only when one side or the other requested them?
They were called only when one side or the other requested them. And that was not necessarily well played out. I think it was the second or the third meeting. The staff officers, both KPA and UNC side, were setting up T2, getting everything ready, laying up pencils and all the other stuff. And one of the NCOs ran in and told me that the KPA guard up in front of Panmunjom Gak had pulled his weapon out and was holding his weapon prior to the meeting. So I got hold of my counterpart and said, hey, we're canceling the meeting, and here's why. So he got with his security guy, they chatted, security guy left, they came back in. My counterpart apologized, said, sorry about that, we've taken care of it. Because I had said, it's not secure. We can't have officers coming in here when you have a weapon being displayed by one of your guards.
Because the joint security area is supposed to be no weapons on display.
On display. I mean, they're allowed to carry sidearms.
Okay.
But when you pull one out of the holster. Yeah, that's pretty threatening.
Right.
And so we did instead have the meeting, but never quite understood what happened there. I don't know if it was the security guards trying to show something that they didn't talk to the KPA mission folks, but somehow it was not something that they were prepared for. It happened, but they turned around real quick and said, no, we want to have the meeting. It's taken care of.
Right. Was there a way in which these meetings were good at de-escalating crises or managing crises so that they didn't get to be bigger than they could be?
Well, that was certainly the intention. It was probably more noticeable when you got into the West Sea hostilities that took place around the NLL. There was a bit more back and forth at that point in time. There were proposals made on both sides for ways to de-escalate it. Now, obviously, the North Korean proposals were generally unacceptable, and they were not prepared to accept our proposals. The South Koreans also.
But when you say they're unacceptable from the North Korean side, is that because they were in contravention of the armistice agreement?
No, a lot of it has to do with the NLL. And I'm not sure how much you are aware of the NLL. The NLL, to the best that I'm aware of, was established in 68 by Commander-in-Chief of UNC. And it was primarily established because there was a problem with a lot of South Korean fishermen drifting north or fishing up north near the five islands that are up there that are controlled by UNC, and getting grabbed by the North Koreans. So to try to alleviate that, this arbitrary line was drawn that goes around the five islands. And it was pretty much so that the southern folks would stay south of that line and the North Koreans wouldn't try to intercept them. So what it appeared to me at the time, and again, this is my recollection of 30 years ago, was that they were trying to go after that NLL and say that it was not valid as an armistice issue. And it was discussed to some degree as being an armistice issue, but technically, because there was no MDL that ran into the West Sea, it was not. And that was where the confusion was. And that was probably a tactical point on their side to try to be able to twist things around. And what their ultimate goal was, who knows? They weren't going to get us to change our positions on any of that, and we weren't going to be able to change their position. Now, a lot of things, and this is my own assessment, a lot of things that were happening with the KPA mission was they were having to deal with their leadership in Pyongyang as well. And a lot of times I think they were directed to do some things that they may or may not have felt so inclined to do, but they had no choice.
Mm-hmm.
So the NLL issue, as I understand it, and I hadn't followed that closely, has probably never resolved itself. Nothing ever came out of those discussions. But if you want to say that the fact that we got together and talked on two or three meetings about the issue, then you could probably say, yes, there is a case for de-escalating. Because for one thing, it allowed time to go past.
Right.
And as time goes past and there's no further conflicts or hostile activities, then it does allow for some breathing room.
Right. Now, what kinds of issues were beyond the purview of the general officers' talks? What were the things that were above the pay grade of what could be discussed there?
That's kind of unknown. I mean, we always tried to go into these meetings, the ones that we called, for a reason. We had the Yugo submarine, of course. We had the sinking of the ISILC down south. And I'm not sure if you know what an ISILC is.
What is that?
Okay, it's a submersible vehicle that travels just below the surface of the water. And it was intercepted by the South Koreans. They shot it up and sunk it and killed the crew. Mm-hmm. So when it was presented at the GEO talk that this boat had infiltrated into the south, we'd intercepted it. It had been sunk. We had the crew member bodies and were willing to return it. But then we issued a protest. Now, their response is, we don't know anything about this. Couldn't be ours. Let's just drop it. So we never returned the remains for those crew members of the ISIL. The Yugo, they had the story. It drifted down south while it was training on the coast, and you guys snatched it.
Right.
A couple of other incidents. It generally, for our side, ended up being provocations. Meeting with them to discuss provocations and issuing protests if appropriate. Theirs was mostly to try to change the system.
So when you say a provocation, would that include like the satellite launch that North Korea did in 1998 or missiles, or would it more localized stuff along the demilitarized zone that we're talking about?
It's armistice related only.
Okay.
Now, the missiles being fired is not, it's not so much an armistice issue, because there's nothing in the armistice that refers to launching missiles or satellites or anything like that. So it's definitely military centric. We did at times meet with them to do some civilian kinds of things, like facilitate crossovers, like the Hyundai president, I think he crossed over into the north. We brought a Kido body back. We were not personally involved in it other than to facilitate it.
Okay.
So again, those ended up being, you know, maybe one staff officer meeting for the Kido remains return, and then a JDO meeting to facilitate getting people up there to get the body and bring it across. No military were on the line at the time when that happened. So we tried to maintain a very strict separation from anything civilian that happened against anything military. Again, if the North Koreans came to us and said, "Hey, we got a body here of a guy doing the Kido thing. Can you help us get him back?" Then we would do that. But again, it would be very
Kido. This is the under the agreed framework, the plan to build some light water nuclear reactors in North Korea. Is that right?
I believe so. I didn't.
Korea Energy Development.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't aware that anyone from the Kido project had died.
Yeah, they had one guy die of a heart attack.
Oh, I see. Okay, while working the project.
He was fairly overweight. But they came to us and said, "Hey, this guy's died. Kido wants to return him back to Panmunjom. Can you help facilitate it?" And again, this was more of a cooperative effort. We said we'd be happy to. We contacted the Kido people. We explained to them what they needed to do, because we would not be physically involved in the repatriation, and then that made it happen. So we did do things sometimes that were outside of the purview of armistice, but that was more courtesy things.
Right. I've just looked it up now. It's the Korean Peninsula Energy Development Organization, KEDO. So that's for our listeners at home there, you can look that up.
I had enough on my plate. I didn't need to learn much more about what was going on.
Right. South Korea, as you explained earlier, was outside these bilateral general officers talks, but that was okay because President Kim Dae-jung accepted that and said, you go on ahead and have the bilateral talks.
No. That's not correct.
Oh.
The South Koreans did not agree with the concept of general officer talks at all, because they were saying that, and correctly so, to be quite accurate, they believe the MAC was the appropriate forum.
That's the Military Armistice Commission.
Right. Now, what we were doing with the procedural documents was to try to get it away from the bilateral proposals, which is what they were wanting. And we essentially got it back to a MAC-like structure. We had a U.S. general officer sitting at the table. We had a South Korean general officer sitting at the table. And we had one of the representatives sitting on the table. So it was essentially everything you would see on the MAC south of the MDL.
Right.
And then, on the North Korean side, of course, it was the same KPA. It looked just like a MAC meeting. They just would not accept it as a MAC meeting.
Huh.
So just to make sure it's clear, when we were negotiating the wording for the document, the procedural document, it was with the intention of never allowing it to be anything other than an UNC MAC style meeting. We always refused any bilateral effort on their part to make it a bilateral event. Even trilateral, we wouldn't accept that either, because we wanted that other country representative sitting there so that he could represent UNC along with everyone else on that side of the table. So it was not the bilateral per se that the South Koreans were opposed to. It was the general officers talk in general, because it was not the MAC. Then Kim Dae-jung came in and he said, "We need to do something to show that we're willing to cooperate with them." Then the negotiations got even stiffer. It went actually from staff officer level meetings to secretary level meetings, because we were making it very clear that it was not going to be anything except our side was going to be the same group of people that you always meet. And they eventually gave into that. I mean, they tried everything from, let's not have a meeting at T2, let's have it at T3. Let's have it in Panlong at the Freedom House, or let's have, they tried everything to wordsmith it the way they could. And we just kept saying no. And we almost got, I think there was one sticking point, which I can't even remember what it is anymore on the procedural document, before we were pretty much forced to sign it anyway.
Okay, so basically the meetings ended up being UNCMAC meetings in all but name.
That's correct. If you even mentioned the word MAC, the North Koreans would go nuts.
Withdrew from that.
That's correct. That's
years correct. Before you. Okay. So, as far as you know, is this general officer dialogue channel still operating today?
I have no idea. I followed it for a couple of years after I left. They did have more general officer meetings for the couple of years that I kind of followed it, primarily through Colonel Tharp, who, being a friend and, you know, kind of saying, hey, here's what's going on. But after that, it's pretty much I was doing completely different things and wasn't able to follow what was going on.
Okay. Looking back on it now, more than 25 years later, what do you think is the significance of it all? Why is it still relevant or important today?
It's more frightening that there may be no talks whatsoever, whether it's secretary level, staff level, JDO, GO. GO served a service of its own. Like I say, it does offer an opportunity for either side to kind of de-escalate things. And again, the NLL is a perfect example, or the West Sea incidents were a perfect example of how that, you know, there may be people disagree with me, but I think what it did do was by spacing out the meetings and talking about it gave time for both sides to say, what do we need to do here? And like I say, after the second meeting to discuss the West Sea incident, the North Koreans came up with some proposals of their own to try to resolve the issue. They were unrealistic, but again, if the intent of general officer talks or meetings was to de-escalate, give people time to sit down and think about, you know, what do we need to do to respond to this situation? And the response is offer proposals, whether they're accepted or not, you have in fact de-escalated it to a certain extent. So I would say that if they're not having meetings now, I'm not sure if they are, I want to say that I had heard they were not having meetings anymore, then that's unfortunate. How to get back to those, it's probably very difficult to say, because without knowing exactly what happened that led to the break off completely, I would be just postulating.
Right, but in the ideal world, you'd like to see them restarted and regularized or institutionalized.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's
bringing us back to Winston Churchill's old quote that to George Orr is better than to war, right?
Yes, and I want to throw this in there. The 2 years that I was there, 1992 to 1994, I, like probably 95% of the rest of the U.S. military on the peninsula, knew nothing about what was going on at Panmunjom. Right. No idea. It was just not something that came on the scope of the rest of the military, because they were doing their own missions. And I can give you an example of how startled people are when they hear about UNCMAC. Was I had to go to a briefing for someone from Washington, and the SYNC UNC was there, and I was just sitting in the back. I was kind of representing UNCMAC. And the visitor said, there's been some discussion about South Korean POWs in the north. And the SYNC said, well, I'm not real sure what's going on with that. And so I spoke up and said, sir, I met with the KPA yesterday. I asked them if they had any knowledge or any information to provide concerning South Korean POWs in the north. And their response was, there are no South Koreans in the north that don't want to be there.
Mm.
So I looked at the SYNC, and the SYNC looked at me, and he was going, who the heck are you? Why are you here? And what are you doing meeting with the North Koreans? So
just for our listeners who may not be aware, so SYNC is Commander-in-Chief, right?
Commander-in-Chief of the United Nations Command, yes. So again, it just kind of gives you an idea of how a lot of things were going on.
Mm.
It's like the proverbial duck, you know, it's very calm on the surface, but his feet are doing this. There was a lot of things going on. I mean, there were a lot of incidents. When I did my turnover with my predecessor, things were not looking very good as far as continued meetings with the North Koreans. And he told me, he says, I tell you, he said, you're probably going to have a boring 2 years. And then we had incident after incident after incident after incident. This was before the GO talks even.
Right.
And they all required a number of staff officer and secretary level meetings. So we continued to have contact. We had a huge firefight in the DMZ. We had two Taesadong farmers that were taken by the KPA. And it was one of the few times the KPA asked us if we wanted to participate in a joint investigation.
Oh.
We had a swimmer delivery, or a swimmer infiltrator that his body washed up on the beach. They said they didn't know anything about it. It's not their guy. We had a KPA soldier who was out looking for a battery for his boss, fell in the river, came down south, got captured. He was held for almost two weeks.
Wow.
We were negotiating back and forth because the press was continually changing the story. He wanted it effect. He didn't want it effect. He wanted it effect. He didn't want it effect. So when they would come out and say he wanted it effect, the KPA would call a meeting and say, okay, give him back. When it came out, said, well, not really. He didn't really want it effect. Then they said, well, we don't care. If he doesn't want it effect, that's fine. So this went back and forth. We had quite a few meetings on this issue. And the real issue was, under armistice, you couldn't keep POWs. He
right.
was a soldier. He was in uniform, and he was being held in the South.
Yep.
Again, not for any ulterior motive, but because he was not sure what he wanted to do. And so he ended up becoming a Geneva Convention. I'm sorry. It was under the Geneva Conventions, you have to release POWs under armistice, or you can't
right.
keep POWs. So eventually he was returned, but we had that going on. We had these continuous events that continued to allow us to have contact for good reason. So mm-hmm. my concern now would be if they're having similar types of incidences and we're not having any meetings with them, that's probably not a good thing.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I agree that just on the de-escalation issue alone, it's important to keep those conversations going. Offhand, just before we finish there, Aaron, do you happen to know how the investigation into the two farmers that were taken from Daesongdong finished up? Were they given back at some point? Do you know?
They were released, yes. It was quite interesting because the Daesongdong, I didn't know this, because they're farming in the DMZ.
Yeah.
They have a battalion security go out with them to protect them. And these two farmers kind of meandered over to, I think it was a chestnut tree, that they were collecting chestnuts. And so they got out of sight of their guard.
Oh.
And then all of a sudden, the next thing we know, we got a meeting called by the KPA saying, hey, we got a couple of folks here that we think you need to come talk to us about. And so ultimately, we did have a joint investigation, very rare. And we went and I didn't participate in that, but they went and they checked out where the chestnuts were. They talked to the farmers. And the farmer says, yeah, we may have accidentally crossed over the MDL. And the KPA said, well, if they accidentally walked over the MDL, then we'll return them back to the South. So it was a setup kind of a situation that they knew they were going to get all kinds of good propaganda out of. And so it turned out to be okay and that we got them both back. Again, it just shows how so many things can happen. Many times they were planned by the North Koreans to provoke for some purpose.
Yeah.
We even had one meeting. It was stupid. They called meetings almost every major American holiday because they knew we would come. We had to come. And one that I distinctly remember, they came in and they were all furious. Our guards are angry. They're going to blow their top. Bad things are going to happen. You don't want this to happen. You're going to have to do something about this problem. And so we go into this meeting for another hour, and we said, what's the problem? And they said, well, there's some disgusting things that are on the wall in the JDO's office that's really getting our guards angry. Oh. So we sent a guy back to the JDO's office. He comes in and he's got a biking calendar. And on the page that the calendar's month, it had a picture of a girl wearing a biking outfit. It was a tight biking outfit, but it was a biking outfit. And they said, this was, you know, provoking our guards. Now, they had to have a very, very strong high lens binocular to see through the window into the JDO's office, all the way to the back of his office.
Right.
Posted up on a bulletin board to see this. So they were told we had to have a meeting. And they came up with a reason for the meeting.
Goodness me. Well, thank you. We've run out of time for today, but okay. I do appreciate you sharing your experiences there at Panmunjom from 97 through to 99 and about the talking about setting up the general officers meetings and why it's important to keep those channels of dialogue open at all times, especially when tensions are high and rising as they might be, as they appear to be right now. So, thanks once again for coming on the show, Aaron.
Thank you for having me.
Keeping up with South Korea's fast-paced developments just got easier. Welcome to the Korea Pro podcast, your weekly briefing on the stories that matter. Hosts Jongmin Kim and John Lee dissect topics from diplomacy to technology, ensuring you're always informed. Our episodes are a must for professionals in and out of Seoul. Subscribe on your preferred platform and elevate your understanding of Korean affairs. Korea Pro Podcast, where clarity meets depth. Ladies and gentlemen, that brings us to the end of our podcast episode for today. Our thanks go to Brian Betts and Alana Hill for facilitating this episode. And to our post-recording producer genius, Gabby Magnuson, who cuts out all the extraneous noises, awkward silences, bodily functions, and fixes the audio levels. Thank you, and listen again next time.